Mr. Rappel, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Mark Rappel, and I represent the appellant in this matter, David DeGarmo. The primary issue before the court today is the ruling from the Lancaster County District Court surrounding a motion to suppress that was filed in the county court, which was ultimately affirmed by the district court, surrounding the admissibility of a urine test that was secured by law enforcement as part of a DUI drug investigation. And ultimately, the county court found that the urine results were admissible. Mr. DeGarmo was convicted. He appealed to the district court. They affirmed the conviction. They affirmed the ruling of the county court regarding the suppression issue. There seems to be no dispute in this case that the obtained law enforcement's acquisition of Mr. DeGarmo's urine did, in fact, constitute a search. And there's no dispute that search was not done pursuant to a search warrant. The issue before this court is whether or not the warrantless search of Mr. DeGarmo's urine was justifiable under one of the exceptions to the search warrant requirement. And based on the facts of this case, there's really only potentially three exceptions to the search warrant that would apply. The first would be whether or not this was a valid search incident to arrest. Alternatively, was it valid consent? And lastly, whether or not there was any exigent circumstances. I'll touch briefly on the exigent circumstances. That was never advanced as a justification for this particular search, neither on appeal to the district court or on appeal to this court through the attorney general's brief. So I think the main issue before the court today is whether or not this would constitute a search incident to arrest or whether or not consent was valid in this particular case. And as this court's aware, in Birchfield in 2016, the United States Supreme Court found that the search incident to arrest exception to the warrant requirement does not apply to blood test cases. It does apply to breath test cases. The Birchfield court was absolutely silent on whether or not urine would be applicable to the search incident to arrest
exception. In the post-Birchfield era, is this a correct statement that courts are split on the treatment of urine?
Your Honor, to my knowledge, the courts actually are not split on this issue. There's been three, that I'm aware of, three state Supreme Courts that have ruled on this issue, and all three state Supreme Courts unanimously agree with the appellant in this case that a search incident to arrest exception does not apply to urine because urine is more like blood and less like breath. I'm not aware of any authority to the contrary.
Are you limiting it to state Supreme Courts as opposed to intermediate courts?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any intermediate courts, and if I'm mistaken, I apologize, but in terms of my research, that was what I was able to find. So, as I cite in my brief...
And I take it the federal courts haven't jumped into this yet?
To my knowledge, no, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any federal court opinions that disagree with the three states or Supreme Courts that I cite, which is Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. South Dakota, I've all found.
When you referred to the unanimity, were you referring just to the three courts were unanimous, or were you referring to the individual members of all of the courts?
Your Honor, I'll be honest, I don't know the breakdown of each individual court, just the majority of those three state Supreme Courts agree that urine is more like blood and thus needs a warrant, and search incident to arrest exception would not apply.
And was the good faith exception involved in any of those cases?
It was involved in a couple of those cases, Your Honor, and I'm not sure. Actually, I take that back. I think some of those cases involved where the person actually refused. And so I think the good faith exception wasn't applicable because there was nothing to suppress. The person refused the test, so there was nothing to suppress. So in that, I'm not sure that the good faith exception was applicable in either of those two cases. But as I can allude to later, I'm not sure it should be applicable to this case either. But what we're dealing with here, again, when the courts have analyzed this, they took the Birchfield model and said, look, okay, how is blood and urine more similar to each other?
In our situation, though, Mr. Rappel, there is a consent. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, I agree.
How does that change?
That obviously, that would take us into a different exception to the search warrant requirement. And if you'd like to, I could touch on that briefly. Yes, this case is unique and distinguishable from the three Supreme Court cases I've cited from other states, in that there is an allegation of consent. So, yes, this court must address whether or not this was voluntary consent, whether or not it was an unconstrained choice.
And if we do that, we don't have to get to the question of whether or not need a warrant, a urine sample.
That is correct, Your Honor. If the court rules that the search was valid based upon valid consent, a warrantless exception under that, then you wouldn't have to touch the search incident to arrest. I think both the state and myself are urging the court to touch on that issue because I think it is something that is kind of plaguing the courts, the lower courts at this point. And in fact, I think that's why the Attorney General asked for the court to take this case to kind of clarify that issue. But yes, to answer your issue as to consent, so the issue then would be whether or not consent was in fact valid in this particular case. It can't be the result of any express, implied, or physical or psychological coercion. And it's our position that the totality of the circumstances surrounding the consent in this case was not voluntary. It was not an unconstrained choice.
This is a little bit different situation, an implied consent form and then a separate consent for the urine test. Is that correct?
Yes. What you had here was an implied consent form. And I think what's important, though, and I think to guide you in this, I would urge the court to look at the lower court's ruling on the motion to suppress. I believe it's on transcript pages 10 and 11. The lower court found that it says, at 11:08 a.m., Deputy Schwartz read the defendant the introductory advisement warning, as well as Part A of the post-arrest chemical test advisement form, which is Exhibit 3, in which the defendant was informed that he would be arrested for a separate crime of refusal if he refused to provide a sample of his breath and or urine. So the lower court made a specific factual finding.
The form, is it checked both breath and urine, or is it just checked as urine?
The court made a factual finding that the top half of the form, he was read that he would be charged with a crime for breath or urine if he refused either. But on the bottom half of the form, Part B of the form, the officer only checked the breath portion, not the urine portion. So any suggestion by the state that the officer was only referring to urine, I think contradicts the factual findings that were made by the lower court, where the lower court specifically found that he read the top half of the form, which had both breath and urine. And any confusion that was injected into this case was the result of a defective form. If the law enforcement officer really only intended to threaten prosecution with a breath test, then why is the word urine even on the form? And the lower court made a factual finding that he did, in fact, read him that form.
Was there any confusion on the subsequent written consent form that pertained only to urine? Is it your contention there was any confusion there?
I don't think there was any confusion. I think the consent form is a little more clear in that respect. However, that was all, again, that consent form, I think you need to interpret in the context of everything else that was going on here. Again, you have somebody who was stopped at 1027. He was subjected to roadside field sobriety tests. He was arrested, placed in handcuffs, transported from the scene, subjected to even further field sobriety tests. So this is a little more intrusive, a little more coercive than I would argue than a typical DUI case. Then he was at detox. He was then read this post-arrest chemical test advisement form that the lower court found he was threatened that if he didn't take a breath or urine test, he'd be charged with a crime.
May I ask a question?
Yeah.
What do you think the trial judge had in front of him that allowed him to make a factual finding as to what specifically was read? Was that portion of the examination recorded for the judge to review?
My recollection, and from the motion to suppress testimony, and that's the factual findings you're addressing, is that correct, Your Honor?
Correct.
Okay. My understanding is that the officer testified that he read him the post-arrest chemical test advisement form, which would be the top half of the form. So I do believe there's a basis for the judge to make that factual finding because the officer testified that he read him the form. And on that form, the top half, it does say urine and breath, not just breath. Granted, the bottom, the box wasn't checked with that.
So if we're in the consent analysis, let me kind of go back into what's the landscape on the cases that you identified. Yes. Well, the North Dakota case, was the analysis limited to incident to an arrest?
Yes.
Does that inform our analysis in the next pigeonhole on consent?
The three cases I cite don't address consent. Consent wasn't an issue in either of those three cases, in any of those three cases. So it doesn't inform your decision on consent, but it does inform your decision on search incident to arrest. So if the court just wants to focus on consent, again, I would argue that the totality of the circumstances...
Well that helps me, given our previous dialogue. I mean, thank you.
The totality of circumstances with heavy, heavy emphasis, enormous emphasis on the fact that he was threatened with a crime, on top of all the other things of being taken from the scene, handcuffed, told he would do this, and of course his testimony to the fact that he felt he didn't have a choice, his will was overborne, I think that goes into this not being voluntary consent.
So Mr. DeGarmo is asking to suppress the results of the urine test.
Correct.
What benefit does the urine test provide for the state in this case? And does the admission of it, is it harmless error?
Sure. To address the harmless error, yes, obviously there's some evidence that he'd ingested marijuana. He admitted as such. There's marijuana found on his person. So what do the urine results mean? Is it truly harmless? I would argue it's not harmless because The confirmatory test and the urine test is part of the DRE protocol. There's like a 13-step protocol that must be followed, and one of those protocols is that there be a confirmatory test. If the confirmatory test is not admissible, now we get into the issue of, is his opinion even admissible? Deputy Swore's opinion is based solely upon the DRE protocol. Now, does it satisfy Daubert? Does it satisfy the methodology and training if you keep out that urine result? How does it affect the ability? And there could be some arguments made by the defense that maybe should be inadmissible, and that's something I think would be serving the gatekeeping function of the court.
Counsel, before you sit down, could you, what is your position with respect to the preservation issue that the state raises on whether the motion to suppress issues were preserved at all for our appellate review?
Yes, Your Honor. The record is unclear. Obviously, we have a situation.
Why is it unclear?
Well, I think the record's unclear, not through the fault of defense counsel. I wasn't trial counsel. I'm on appeal. But the record establishes that at the time Abigail Dodds, a forensic scientist, was testifying or getting ready to testify to the results of the urine, there was an objection made and an approach was made by the counsel. The sidebar and all the conversations surrounding the basis for the objection is not on the record.
In fact, none of the sidebars during trial are on the record, are they?
Correct.
And what do we know about that? What can you tell us about that?
I can tell you that there's nothing in the record that where the defense counsel asked that the sidebars not be on the record. And I can tell you, as I cite in my my reply brief, at Nebraska Court Rule of Appellate Practice 2105A1, states that court reporting personnel shall in all instances make a verbatim record of the evidence offered at trial or other evidentiary proceedings, including but not limited to objections to any evidence and rulings therefrom and motions and stipulations by the parties. And importantly, this record may not be waived. This is a situation where trial counsel couldn't have waived the sidebars being on the record according to this court rule. And so any suggestion that the record is unclear, I don't think should fall at the feet of the defense counsel. It should fall at the feet of the trial court for neglecting to put these things on the record.
So where does that take us if we agree with you that the rule 2-105A1 applies to this situation? Have we ever said in our previous cases invoking that rule, what happens?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any cases that say what should happen. I do think, though, if you look at the timing and the context of the objection and when it was made, given the exact time the forensic scientist was about to testify to the results, I think it's pretty clear, although it's not expressly on the record, that the objection was going to be designed. I think it's apparent from the record that the objection was designed to object to the urine results and to hopefully keep the motion to suppress issue alive.
In some cases, we have reversed and remanded for a new trial if the portion of the missing record was wholly unavailable to us. Do you think that is a necessary remedy in this case?
Obviously, it's up to the court if that's a necessary remedy. It's a remedy we'd welcome, obviously, if the record is insufficient for the court to properly address this issue. And we need to make a better record, we would ask the court to do that.
Is it your position that we can tell from the existing record, skinny as it is, that the objection was made and overruled?
I think an argument can be made that the context does provide that. But again, it's not absolutely clear. And if there's any uncertainty, if the court feels the need to clarify it, then we would ask the court to give us that opportunity.
Is this an equipment issue in the county court when the sidebar comes up and the judge hits the button so that it's not being broadcast across the entire room, that recording is not being made at that point?
Yeah, I think it's my understanding a lot of times that there could be situations, but again, a lot of times there are times when the judge may say, do you want this on the record or off the record? But again, I think it puts counsel in a tough position where every time we approach, we have to ask the judge if we're on the record, when I think the rule is pretty clear that it has to be on the record and can't be waived.
Yeah, if it is an equipment issue, is that put the parties in a position where they need to ask the jury to be removed from the room whenever they want to have a sidebar?
Yeah, I think that's probably correct. But again, I don't know how counsel would know there's an equipment issue until after the fact when the record's made.
Correct. Is there some reason why the jury couldn't have heard the objection?
Your Honor, I wasn't trial counsel. I would assume just in practicing in Lancaster County, a lot of judges want you to make the objections at the bench and not in front of the jury in grandstanding. So again, I wasn't trial counsel. I can't answer that with experience. It's unclear from the record. But I would, just in experience, I have seen cases where judges prefer the objections be made up front. For those reasons, we ask the court to reverse the lower court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Liss. Good morning again.
Morning again.
May it please the court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. The state maintains that DeGarmo is not entitled to relief on the denial of his motion to suppress. As set forth in our brief, we submit he's not entitled to relief for three reasons. Number one, he failed to timely renew his motion to suppress at trial. Number two, even if the motion to suppress was preserved, it was properly denied. And number three, any error with the admission of the urine test was harmless. I'm going to briefly address all three responses. I'm actually going to start with the first and the third, because in light of the fact that this claim is arguably not preserved and harmless in our view, that this court could arguably avoid the merits altogether. As far as the failure to preserve the motion to suppress, the record reflects that the evidence in this case began with and consisted primarily of testimony from Deputy Schwartz, who was the arresting officer and a DRE officer. He testified at trial without objection that he was under the opinion that, based on all of his observations, that DeGarmo was under the influence of marijuana. He also testified without objection that a urine test took place, and it confirmed his opinion. There was no objection prior to or during his testimony on either point, so we would submit that the motion to suppress was not timely renewed. As far as the appellate rule that Mr. Apple points to and your question, Justice Stacey, about cases which have remanded, I guess my response to that would be twofold. One, I'm not familiar with what exactly those cases say, but my response still would be twofold. Number one, appellants have the ability to fix a record even once it's up on appeal. The appellate rules allow that to be done. That wasn't done, and it's the appellant's burden to provide a record. They could have corrected that if they felt that needed to be corrected, and they didn't.
However, if this was an equipment issue, and it simply doesn't exist, they couldn't correct it. Could they?
If it wasn't, and I don't know what the issue is, but they could have sought to do so. And,
or a practice issue by the court.
Right. I mean, we don't know what the issue is since it wasn't addressed. I'm simply pointing out that they could have attempted to do something if something could be done. I don't know. And my second response would be that even to the extent that could pose a bigger problem here, I don't think it warrants a remand because of the harmless error, and alternatively, the claim would be without merit. So I don't see any reason for a remand here. Moving on to the harmless error, the record reflects that the urine test did not and could not establish the amount of marijuana that DeGarmo had in his system or whether he was actually impaired by the marijuana. The only thing the urine test established in this case, and the only thing it could establish, as the record reflects, was that he had marijuana in his system. But that was undisputed at trial, given that DeGarmo had told Deputy Schwartz during the traffic stop that he had smoked marijuana prior to driving, and then DeGarmo himself testified at trial and admitted under oath that he had smoked marijuana just minutes before driving. So the urine test merely confirmed this undisputed fact. It was cumulative of this undisputed fact.
Would that have impacted the officer's opinion under the DRE?
No, I respectfully disagree with Mr. Rappel's assertion on that point. I mean, the DRE is a 12-step process, and the final step is obtaining that urine test, which, as Deputy Schwartz explained, it provides confirmation of their opinion. But not obtaining that wouldn't mean that an officer's opinion would be inadmissible. I mean, if that were the case, then any time somebody refuses, an officer can't come in and testify about their observations and opinion. I mean, every case would just be torpedoed any time a defendant is smart enough to just refuse to provide that urine sample. So that just can't be, and I'm not aware of any authority that says that's the case. So I would disagree with Mr. Rappel in that regard.
What's the purpose of the urine test being part of the protocol?
Just to, I guess, follow up and just confirm that the person does, in fact, have that substance in their system. I mean, it doesn't hurt, you know, and you look at
Is it necessary?
Is it necessary?
Yeah.
For a DRE result to be valid?
Yeah.
No, not to my knowledge. And I don't know how it could be, especially in the context of if somebody refusing or you can't get it or whatever.
There's been Daubert examinations of this process. Is that correct?
Of the DRE, yes, there have been.
And is it required under the DRE that that last step be done? Is there anything, any reference in those cases?
I don't recall off the top of my head, but if I seem to recall researching this back when I briefed State v. Rothenberg, so I think went through State v. Daly dealt with this, and as I recall, that was not required. I don't want to misstate what that case says. It's been a while since I've looked over it, but to my recollection, no, it's not required, and if the case does say that, I guess I would take some issue with it because I don't know how that will work, as I just said, because if you don't get that sample, and I remember making that argument in that case, and then the whole thing doesn't work, and that just doesn't make sense to me.
And in this situation, there's other evidence about marijuana consumption, is that correct?
Right, there is, yeah. The officer had, you had the admission, you have him showing some signs of impairment, his behavior, his taste buds being raised. I think he had a greenish hue on his tongue, a number of observations that were indicative of having ingested marijuana. And again, that was undisputed anyway, the fact that he had it in his system. But yeah, as far as signs of impairment, yes, there was other evidence of that too. But the urine test didn't provide signs of impairment. I mean, that was a separate issue altogether. All the urine test does is confirm or dispel whether or not the person has urine in their, or marijuana in their system. And so that doesn't even go toward impairment one way or the other, which is really, in a nutshell, why I would submit this harmless, because it doesn't do anything other than that. And we already know that. He himself admitted that. So I just don't see what the urine test adds in this case. And it doesn't exclude the officer's
because
testimony.
Because unlike alcohol testing, where you come up with actually a digital reading, and it's an element that can be used to prove the crime, in drug recognition experts or under the influence of a drug, there is no 0.0 reading from the urine that can be used to help prove the crime, correct?
Right.
So it's either recognized or not, right? No objective assessment of quantity.
Correct, and that Ms. Dodds explained that at trial, that it's not scientifically possible for me to tell you if there was a particular threshold here or whether that, if there were a threshold, if he were impaired by it. We can't do it. It's not scientifically possible. All we can tell you is that there was the presence of marijuana in the system.
The issue of consent, what's your argument?
We would submit that the consent was valid and voluntary in this case. As far as, I mean, this post-arrest chemical test advisement form, I mean, it does contain the language that Mr. Rappel's pointing to. It says, I have the authority to direct whether the test or tests shall be of your breath or urine, and may direct that more than one test be given. But then when we get to subsection A, it says, request for test. I hereby direct a test of your breath or urine. There's two separate spaces. Only breath is checked. To determine alcohol or drug content, two separate spaces. Only alcohol is checked. That's the only thing that's filled out and signed. The next subsection, which is subsection B, which says an alternative test for drugs, talks about requesting a test for breath or urine to determine the presence of drugs. That section is entirely blank, which was consistent with Deputy Schwartz's testimony that he was not requesting a test for drugs at that time. He was just going through the DRE steps, and the first one, or one of the first ones, is to test for alcohol through a breath test to eliminate the presence of alcohol, which you then take into account for purposes of your DRE.
What did the defendant consent to?
To provide a urine sample. Well, are you saying at that, with
yeah.
respect to that advice?
Yeah.
That was just consenting to a, and arguably he didn't. I mean, that was a post-arrest chemical test advisement form, which says, at least in that regard, I have the authority to direct you to right. do that for an alcohol breath test, which the officer does under Birchfield. So I guess, with respect to that form, maybe the defendant consented, maybe he didn't. It doesn't matter on that part of it. But
he signed that document and he gave the test.
The breath test?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, he did.
So there is some consent there.
Well, sure. I mean,
he wasn't arrested or charged with a new crime.
I'm sorry?
He wasn't arrested for a new crime or charged with a new crime for refusal.
True. Okay. He did not refuse.
He avoided refusal, but I'm just trying to get the contours of that to which he consented.
Well, yeah, he provided the breath test for alcohol per that advisement form.
Okay.
He did it. It came out to be zeros, no alcohol in the system. Right. And then subsequently, when they continue with the DRE and you get to the later steps and you know the confirmation step of requesting the urine sample,
right.
then you have the separate consent form that was also read to him and he also signed. And that one contains very explicit language. You have a constitutional right to refuse this test. That's your right. Do so if you choose. If you do so choose, we'll obtain a search warrant.
In the post-Birchfield jurisprudence, what are the cases regarding consent as opposed to search incident to arrest?
I am not intimately familiar with what post-Birchfield cases are saying on consent, Your Honor. I've reviewed, went through the cases the appellant relies on last night, and I admittedly, I'm running on fumes at this point in the week, and I just didn't have any to do with the research.
You look familiar.
I'm sorry?
You look familiar.
Yeah, I'm struggling. But I'd be happy to go through those cases if the court has any questions on those. I don't think any of them, well, they're obviously not binding.
So what is the state's position on whether or not you need a warrant for a urine sample?
Well, the state's position, as you would expect, is that you don't. When you go through this balancing test, on the one hand, you have the nature or the degree of intrusion on the person's privacy, and on the other side of the balancing test, you have the government's need for the information. Now, we have several factors that go into that one side of the balancing scale with, you know, degree of intrusion. And, sure, some of those are going to come out to be, arguably more intrusive than a breath test. I don't know that I would say that it's quite as intrusive as blood, but, I'll certainly acknowledge some of those things are going to be more intrusive than breath. But to me, what's paramount is when you get to the other side of the balancing test and you look at the government's need for that information. As we pointed out in our brief, in the context of drug cases, DUID cases, urine's the only way that we can test for this from Title 177 and adduce that information. So I think that has much more significance in this context than in alcohol. And when you look at Birchfield, that portion of the balancing test was absolutely vital because they went through all of that and pointed out, the carnage and staggering statistics from DUIs and said, that does justify doing a search of a person's breath without a warrant. But because there is a, less alternative or less intrusive alternative to do that, we see no reason to go get blood. Blood is a little bit more intrusive, and you have the less alternative or less intrusive alternative to do it, so we're not going to let you do it on blood. But to me, it's totally
different. So the cases seem to be going the other way, however.
To say that it's more like blood, you mean?
Yes.
Again, I have not, as I told Justice Miller, and I have not had an opportunity to do extensive research on this. But with respect to the three cases the appellant relies on, I'll just briefly walk through those. The Thompson case from Minnesota, I don't think that really has any application here. That was a DUI alcohol case. And there, just like anywhere else, you have the option of doing a breath test. So they basically went through just a standard Birchfield analysis and said, hey, no, you're not going to get urine without a warrant because you can get breath. So it's basically just Birchfield all over again, which makes sense. Helm out of North Dakota, well, in that one, it admittedly does support the appellant's position, but when you read that analysis...
I beg your pardon, but is that an incident to an arrest case?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So they go through the analysis and they do the balancing test and they go through all the factors to say, looking at the intrusion or the nature of the invasion of this person's privacy, urine is more like blood. But then when they get to the other side of the balancing test, which I think is pivotal, they do nothing. The extent of their analysis on that is, while the lack of an intrusive test, a less intrusive test may weigh in favor of the reasonableness of the state, we're not persuaded. And that's the extent of their analysis. They did half the analysis, half the balancing test. I'm sorry, I can't get behind that analysis. But I mean, the holding does support their position, but I don't think the analysis does.
Going back to the source, at this point, the United States Supreme Court has not disapproved of implied consent statutes with regard to urine, such as Nebraska's.
They have not.
Is it the state's position that a urine test in a case where we're talking about a DRE exam is somehow different, that the balancing test is different in a DRE case than it is in a DUI case because urine plays a different role in the investigation?
All right, when you're saying DRE, you mean drug case versus DUI alcohol case?
Correct.
Yes. And the answer would be yes. Absolutely.
Because of the role the urine test plays and the unavailability of another kind of test.
Right.
Thank you.
So it's more important for the state... And that's what you're talking about with the second part of the analysis.
Correct. Right. Yeah. You got two sides of the scale, two sides of the balancing test, and the government's need for the information. To me, that's its own balancing, own side of the scale here. That, to me, is pivotal in these drug cases with respect to urine, at least in Nebraska, because under Title 177, we have no other means to test for drugs and present that information. So in a DUI case, if it's drug-based, that's the only way to do it. We don't have breath as a less intrusive alternative. There's nothing else.
So how does that square with your harmless error argument?
Well, I mean, the fact that it came in doesn't mean that it established he was under the influence. The only thing he ended, the only thing it established was that he had it in his system, and he admitted that anyway. So I don't think that in any way blows up the harmless error argument. I think it's separate from it. But
well, does your harmless error argument blow up the argument that you just made that the state absolutely needs to get a urine test in drug cases?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, it's still going to be probative, and in many cases, you aren't going to have somebody who just admits they have drugs in their system. If they don't, as many people don't, this is going to be the only way to confirm it. So I don't believe it does.
Is urine the only available option in drug cases because Title 177 says that's the case, or because there's some physical or scientific impossibility of using breath?
It's generally a limitation because of Title 177. There is a separate statute out there that talks about the possibility of, like, if a blood test is taken when somebody's in a hospital for medical treatment, that could conceivably be turned over to law enforcement. And there's some question floating around out there about to what extent, if and when we obtain that, can we use that in, like, a drug case. But the problem we run into is, foundationally, to admit chemical test results. Requirements that this court's laid
oral
out
swabs are being used now to check for the presence of drugs. Is that authorized by Title 177?
No. And that comes back to Justice Packard's question that one of the foundational requirements we have, and we've been litigating a lot lately, is that when you've gone through all these steps and obtained chemical test results, that you've complied with all of our state statutes and you've complied with the regulations set forth by the Department of Health and Human Services, i.e. Title 177. So generally speaking, I think most people view that as saying you got to follow Title 177, its methods and its procedures, in order to get something in the form of a chemical test result. And so we got to grapple with that limitation. I'm way out of time. Thank you for indulging me. If there's no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
We gave Mr. Liss a lot of time because we asked him a bunch of questions, Mr. Rappel, so I would give you a couple minutes if you want to, if you've got some rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly. To address the issue about the only available method to test urine in drug cases is urine, no one's saying you can't get the urine. We're just saying you have to get a warrant to do it unless you've got exigent circumstances. And that's one of the big factors that some of these cases analyze in deciding whether or not a warrant should be required is the exigency. And the record's very clear, according to Abigail Dodd's forensic scientist, that the metabolites from THC can remain in somebody's system for weeks, sometimes months, depending on their fat content. And so there's no exigent circumstance necessary, dissipation of evidence, loss of evidence that would be necessary. So obviously the government has an interest in taking drugs off the street and guns off the street. Does that mean they can walk into somebody's house to take it? Not unless there's a viable exception to the warrant. And again, there is options there. If there's exigencies or you can get a warrant, they have more than enough time to do it. Regarding Your Honor's question about the importance of the protocol and the confirmatory test, the reason the confirmatory test is so important in DRE cases is to check on the law enforcement officer. If the law enforcement officer testifies that based upon my testing and my observations, I believe this defendant to be under the influence of depressants, and he writes his report, forms his opinion, but yet the drugs come back and he's got THC in his system, that confirmatory test is important for the defense's ability to confront the accuser and say, you formed an opinion that this guy was under the influence of something that completely was not confirmed by the results. So under that harmless error analysis, it still plays an important role regardless of the admissions the defendant makes.
But we don't have that situation here, though, do we, where we have an admission of marijuana usage?
Correct, Your Honor, but when we're talking about the DRE protocol and whether or not if the defense could have, if the urine results would have been inadmissible, it's potentially we would have been able to keep that out under the DRE protocol and say, look, this shouldn't even come in because of the fact that the protocol wasn't followed. The confirmatory test wasn't followed. We had no way of holding the officer accountable. So I think that's why it's important.
But don't we have confirmation by other means? Didn't the officer have confirmation by other means?
Correct, at the suppression hearing, but not potentially at trial. And I think what you had here is you had the officer testify. I mean, in a trial, the defendant testified. Obviously, that was in front of the jury. But maybe the defendant wouldn't have testified if the results wouldn't have come in. You know, so it's kind of one of these things where it's a gatekeeping function I think the court needs to make. So,
don't we consider the evidence at the motion to suppress and the trial when we're looking at the suppression issue here on appeal?
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The next case of the day is Urancian versus Wilkie Farr and Gallagher, LLC. Justice Miller-Lerman is recused from this matter. She is also recused from the last case of the day. And with that in mind, let's give her a moment to leave the courtroom.